Shalom, everybody. This is Ryan White, and today we are going to be going over a concept block on the ancient Near East. We're going to be using Deuteronomy 15, and we're going to be looking at the concept of slavery or servanthood and the Shemitah. So let's start off by reading Deuteronomy 15 and taking out some important things from this. Deuteronomy 15 verse 1 starts out by saying, at the end of every 7 years, you are to make a release of debts. Now, if you notice there in your Bibles, the word of debts is actually in italics, but it's because that actually doesn't exist there. The word there for release, though, is that word that we use here in the title. It's Shemitah. And that comes from, that's the Hebrew word 8059. In the Strong's, comes from the root word shamat, which is a primitive root, which means to fling down, to jostle, to basically to let alone. It's to discontinue, to release. You're letting go. It's like, you know, you've been doing all this, and then you just stop in the middle of plowing, whatever. And it's like you just let go. You just stop everything and drop it all. And so this terminology here is used specifically for, as we're going to find out, debts, slavery, which, as we'll see, slavery is tied up with debts, and also allowing the land itself to rest. Now, we're not going to get into the land side of this today because that's covered more in the book of Leviticus, but what I wanted to look at here is specifically what is Deuteronomy talking about here, because this is some very important lessons to be taken away from this. Some things that we don't, especially in our culture today, we try to not talk about because there's a lot of criticism, especially with the whole concept of slavery in the ancient Near East. But we're going to get into that and really start to understand that. So the first couple verses here, they talk about that on this Shemitah year, the seventh year, every creditor is to release what he has loaned to his neighbor. He does not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the release of Yahweh. Now, this is very important. Who is your neighbor and who is your brother? We've talked about this in the past. This does not mean every single person in the world, right? Because the very next verse says, of the foreigner, you could require it. And right there it says, you could require it. Not that you have to, but you could require it. But your hand is to release whatever is owed by your brother. Now, the reason for this comes up in the next verse. Only that there should be no poor among you, for Yahweh does greatly bless you in the land which Yahweh your Elohim is giving you to possess as an inheritance. Very important word there, inheritance. We're going to talk about that in the future, probably actually next week. I'm going to go ahead and do a really good, really, really exciting teaching about how the inheritance is tied up in the name and such. Only if you diligently obey the voice of Yahweh your Elohim to guard, to do all these commands which I am commanding you today. For Yahweh your Elohim shall bless you as he promised you. And you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. And you shall rule over many nations, but they do not rule over you. So the whole concept here behind this is that by once every 7 years, there's a complete release of debts. Much like it's essentially kind of like a bankruptcy today, except for there's no negative consequences for that person who's being released from their debt. They're simply free right across the board there. Now, of course, the whole thing there is people are going, well, I'm not going to lend to my brother for a loan that requires more than 7 years because it's going to get overridden on this Shemitah year. So in specifically, of course, Yahweh calls this out and says, when there's a poor man with you, one of your brothers within any of the gates of your land, which Yahweh your Elohim has given you, do not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother. You shall certainly open your hand to him and certainly lend him enough for his need, whatever his needs, not his wants, but his needs, of course. Right? And then specifically, be on guard lest the thoughts of Belial enter your heart and saying, the seventh year, the year of release is near, and your eye is evil against your poor brother. You've given him naught. he shall cry out to Yahweh against you. So, of course, the whole concept here is this is going to be good, and this is what's going to cause Israel itself to be a blessed nation, and so that they can actually lend to other nations. They're going to be the creditor nation. Instead of having a $16 trillion deficit, they would have a $16 trillion abundance of money, overage in their account. So after going into this, then it talks to you and it tells you there are going to be poor people in your land. And whenever your brother is sold to you, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, that person shall serve you for 6 years. Now this is different from the Shemitah year. This isn't a release on that Shemitah year. This is they are going to work for you for 6 years and then let him or her go free from you on that seventh year. Now, however, when you send him away, let him not go away empty-handed. You richly supply him from your flock and from your threshing floor and your winepress with that which Yahweh has given you. And you shall remember that you're a slave in the land of Mitzrayim, and Yahweh your Elohim redeemed you. Therefore, I am commanding you this word today. And it shall be that when he says to you, I do not go away from you, because he loves you and your house, and because it is good for him to be with you, then you shall take an awl and thrust it through his ear at the door, and he shall become your servant forever. Do the same for your female servant. Let it not be hard in your eyes when you send him away free from you, for he has been worth a double hired servant in serving you 6 years, and Yahweh your Elohim shall bless you in doing that. So the whole concept here is that this person, and it's not explicitly stated in the text because this was a custom at the time. This was well known throughout the ancient Near East, as we're going to see here, is that if you fell into debt, you could sell yourself into slavery. And we'll talk about exactly what that meant, because unfortunately, a lot of times today, we kind of push our culture and our mindset of a term onto the scriptures without trying to see what is this term that is called slavery or servanthood, depending on which version you're reading. What does that mean to the people back then instead of what does it mean to us? A lot of times when we think of the term slavery, we automatically have images flashing back of the enslavement of the African people in the U.S. that was, of course, abolished a while back. And so we start to try to make parallels between how they were treated during the time of slavery and the Bible. And, of course, I mean, slavery such as that did for certain exist. I mean, we know that the Hebrews themselves were enslaved in Egypt. But that's not the only context that word is used in. You can see here that this Hebrew servant or slave, when he goes free, not just you're free, now get out of here. He gets the fullness of the blessing of that house. He gets sent out with flocks and all sorts of money and everything like that, right? He goes away rich. And also, if we're talking about the same sort of slavery that we in America are so familiar with, would you expect that this person to possibly say, I do not want to go away with you, I love you and I want to stay with you forever? No. We've got some issues we need to work out here. So we need to look into what exactly is slavery. So the first article that I want to go ahead and read here is from a book. It's called Slaves and Households in the Near East. It's edited by Laura Culbertson, and actually this article that I'm going to be reading from in the book, because the book is a composition of several articles, was written by her. This is really good in defining what a slave is. The term translated as slave generically refers to the lesser constituent in an asymmetrical relationship, where the lesser may be hyphenated by some kind of social, symbolic, or even cosmic ranking. Of course, not all asymmetrical relationships are slavery, but slavery is always expressed in terms of hierarchy, obligation, and domination. So basically, it was very common in any sort of relationship where there is a dominant party for the lesser party to be referred to as a slave. Continuing on here, ideological and religious conceptualizations of slavery often describe hierarchical relationships. Kings are slaves of the gods. Subjects are slaves of kings. The Sumerian term arad is applied to enslaved men, but it can also express lesser ranking of any man related to a higher ranking individual. And in fact, it's even evident in personal names such as Arad Nana, which is literally means slave of the god Nana. And in fact, the Muslims actually do this today. Muslim term, or the Arabic term for slave is abd, abad. It's similar to the Hebrew term abad, but it's abd. And so we often see names like Abdullah. Abdullah means servant of Allah. Their pagan god, or Abdurrahman. And I'm assuming that Rahman, other than being a type of noodle, is also one of the names of their god. He's the god of the noodles. And I don't feel bad for saying that at all. Slavery, even if subsumed under a single term, is described as subordination, dependence, bondage, debt, clientage, or subservice. Right, so this term slavery has a very wide range of usages that it can be used for, and it always is used in a situation where one person essentially is dependent on another person for their leadership, for their providence, and whatnot. Which is why we are called the servants of Yahweh, because we're indebted to Him. We are dependent on Him. We're subordinate to Him. We serve Him. And so the term Eved is a very adequate term and very descriptive of how our relationship is supposed to be. Continuing on here, even if the terms we translate as slave vary widely according to context, in general, people bearing such a designation had diminished legal rights and entitlements in comparison to non-slave persons with whom they interacted. This, of course, does not mean that an enslaved person had no rights, because social, religious, and ideological or cultural practices could ensure the protection of slaves. And we see that throughout the Torah. Throughout the Torah, it talks about, especially with the Hebrew slave, you are to treat him, he's not to eat at a separate table. This Hebrew slave is to be treated with dignity and respect. He's not to be treated like an inferior person. Right? The courts would actually reinforce the imbalance of rights and compelled enslaved people to fulfill their obligations during this period of enslavement. So the whole purpose for this reduction in their legal rights and entitlements is compelling them to ensure that they actually go forth and fulfill their obligation, because people didn't enter into slavery in most parts of the ancient Near East. Now, of course, there's always going to be exceptions, right? But in most parts of the Near East, people didn't enter into slavery simply because they were a member of a certain race or because their color of their skin was a certain color. They entered into slavery for very specific reasons, as we'll find out here. Slavery was not always a permanent condition, and the conditions and terms of enslavement were specific to the circumstances under which enslavement was established. Aside from birth, slavery often originated out of a predicament, such as financial crisis, criminal behavior, family disintegration, capture in wartime, or other crises often resulted in the creation of enslavement. Slavery could be as much a remedy for certain predicaments as it is a setback, by offering outsiders or disenfranchised persons a protected legal status and acknowledgement of a social bond. Now, that's very, very important, as we're going to see here, is that this person could essentially be a nobody, right? I mean, it's like they're out on the street. They have no land. They have no family. They have nothing. They don't even have a place to eat. And so this person could essentially sell themselves into slavery. And oftentimes it wasn't even for a sum of money. They could just go into slavery in order to have food, clothing, and shelter provided for them. And it wasn't just for that, though. Then they actually became part of the family. Let's turn real fast, and we're going to see this here in Exodus 12, verse 43. In Exodus 12, verse 43, this is talking about the laws concerning the Passover. And it starts off by saying, "And Yahweh said to Moshe and Aharon, 'This is the law of the Passover. No son of a stranger is to eat of it. But any servant or slave,'" the same term there, remember, "'a man has bought for silver when you have circumcised him.'" Because remember, your servants or your slaves, if they're in your household, they are supposed to be circumcised, right? So if you've circumcised him, then let him eat of it. The sojourner, the ger, or the hired servant does not eat of it. So what we can see there is that by this person being a servant or being a slave of that household, they're actually made a member of that household. So now they have a lot of the same rights and responsibilities. They are essentially brought into covenant through that circumcision. Remember, because circumcision, according to Torah, is a sign of the covenant. And so this was essentially a way that someone could actually enter into the family of Israel, right? If they didn't have any sort of possession, if they're a foreigner and they wanted to come into the land of Israel, one way for them to do it is to attach themselves to a family in order to enter into that covenant relationship with Yahweh, and then, of course, be able to partake of the blessings, because we see here they're able to partake of the Passover. And the Passover is all about redemption, is it not? A couple more things here in this article. As members of the household, slaves were afforded certain statuses akin to, but not equal to, the free members of the household. The household affiliation itself could be equivalent to protection and secure legal status. You know, it's like, it's kind of like how some people, they come over and in order to get their U.S. citizenship, they marry a U.S. citizen, right? And that gives them the ability to have that legal status and then protection under the U.S. Constitution. So a very similar sort of thing is going on here when we look at it. And in return for having this secure legal status, this protection, this provision, they are required to become a servant, a slave of this household, right? Households, in fact, acted as portals through which foreigners, social outsiders, and even criminals could be reintegrated into society and set on a new direction. Or by the way of gaining a household affiliation, disaffected or lowly persons could gain legally protected status, skill sets or specializations, or entitlement to transfer into other social categories. So, and this is why it's very important. If you've gone back and you watch my series on the rites of passage, you'll notice that I talk about that these periods of seven often have to do with the rites of passage. And rite of passage is a manner in which that a person passes from their old self to a new self. Or it could be they temporarily reduce their status, such as if you're in mourning, right? You go into mourning for this six-day period, and then you're purified. And the same concept is going on here. These people are foreigners, and they're transitioning from the old person, the Gentile, and they're going to go through this transitional period, in which this transitional period, they are going to be a slave in a household. And then at the end of it, then they are incorporated into the greater body of Israel, right? Now, it's really interesting here is that they talk about criminals, right? And this was always something that I didn't really understand. You know, there was a lot of question in my mind about the legal code, because it seems like for every crime, there's a fine that's required. And if you look at some of these fines, these are very hefty fines. These are fines that are worth, I mean, they're getting fined more than the value of an estate. But aside from the cities of protection for a murderer, there really doesn't seem to be any concept of jail. Which, of course, isn't a bad thing. I mean, you look at the U.S. and our jail system, and it's terrible. It's a huge drain on the economy. And these people, they don't go in there and they get rehabbed. They go in there and essentially, you know, that gives them contacts with more criminals. And a lot of them, unfortunately, end up back in prison. And that's, of course, that's not to say everyone. But that's, you know, that's a problem in the prison, is that they don't do, in my opinion, they don't do enough to promote reintegration back into society. So if you look at this, how this would happen in the ancient Near East, let's say you went and you stole something from someone. Let's say you stole a cow from them, right? And if you look at the law codes, if you're caught, you have to give back a large number in return. I think that's in Exodus 23. Let's look here real fast. Yeah, Exodus 22. Here we go. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he repays 5 cattle for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. You know, so let's say this person steals a $1,000 ox and sells it. Now he has to repay five $1,000 oxes, right? And if, let's say he's a, you know, a cattle wrangler and he steals, you know, 20 of them, very quickly he's going to end up with a very high repayment that he has to make. Well, what happens if he doesn't have any money? The same thing that happens if a person runs into economic misfortune and they have no money. What do they have to do? In order to pay off the debts that they're going to incur, they would sell themselves into slavery. Oftentimes they would sell their family, and they would sell themselves into slavery in order to be able to pay off this debt. And what this does is it transfers them out of their own family unit, because Israel was a very family unit conscious society. And it would transfer them out of their own family unit into someone else's family unit, and they would have to work for this person. Now, you know, I'm sure there were bad masters, but in general, the concept here is that you are still treated like, you know, essentially similar to a hired servant. And in fact, you know, the Torah, or the Deuteronomy 15 specifically calls them out as such, that you treat them as a hired servant. Maybe it's not Deuteronomy 15. Maybe I think it's Leviticus 25. We can go there really fast. Scrolling down here, let me look for the exact verse. Leviticus 25, 39 through 41. Way down here at the bottom. And when your brother who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, do not make him serve as a slave, but as a hired servant. And as a settler, he is with you, and he serves you until the Jubilee year. All right, so let's see here the words here in the Hebrew. The word there for slave is ebed, and hired servant is sakir, a man with wages, right? So it differentiates from that the Hebrew person there, the Hebrew servant, is to be treated even better than the equivalent in the other nations in the ancient Near East, right? The other nations would have a standard. I mean, you couldn't just go, you know, this didn't give you complete rights to just kill this person or do whatever you wanted with them, but it still gave you a high level of rights over their body. Oftentimes they could be branded and whatnot. And what Yahweh is saying is that if you treat your brother, you don't treat them like the nations treat their servants. You treat him like you would someone with hired wages. You treat him with dignity. So, going back to the whole idea with the jail concept is that this person, if they commit a crime and they're unable to pay off the penalty, which most criminals probably would be the sort of person who wasn't able to pay off the penalty. Most of the criminals statistically are in the lower class and have less money than other people. So instead of going to a jail where they commingle with tons of other inmates, they have to be sold into debt slavery in order to pay off their debt. And so for 6 years, they would work in the house of someone as their servant. Now, how much better of a rehabilitation is that? You're sent to a private individual who has control over you and makes you actually work, but this person, for one, he's going to be motivated because he wants a better society. And he gets, so he has you, you know, basically learning how to be an upstanding citizen. There's a Sheriff Joe, I don't remember his last name, in Arizona. He actually did something that was controversial. In Arizona, I believe it is. I saw this in the news recently. What he does with his inmates is he dresses them up in pink jumpsuits and he goes out and makes them work. They don't get three hot meals in a nice cot to sleep on all day long. He makes them go out, and during their time, they go out and they work. Well, did you know that he has the lowest rate of reintroductions into the jail system? Most of the criminals that commit crime, they're either they go to another county and commit crime, or they stop committing crime, is because he doesn't give them an easy time. He goes out and he shows them how to be a productive member of society. And I believe that's the concept that we're seeing here, is that Yahweh wants these people to be rehabilitated through these sorts of methods. There's another great article that I'm going to read parts of here. This is Slavery in the Ancient Near East by Isaac Mendenhall. Lack of employment or debts drove people to sell first their children and then themselves into slavery. Voluntary self-sale was a common phenomenon, especially among strangers who had neither kin nor friends to tide them over in times of distress. But even natives sometimes resorted to this desperate step. All right, and here we have, this is from the third dynasty in Ur. So around the time of Abraham here. Kurudum by name and Niatum by name, the children of Apil Kubi, brother of Habanatum, from themselves Balmuname has bought for their debt 1/3 mina of silver, as their full price he has paid. He who brings a claim against them, 1 mina of silver will pay. So this man, because of these people's debt to them, he basically purchased them for a third mina of silver, and then they're going to work off the rest of it, basically. Now, if a kinsman redeemer wants to come and purchase them from them, they're going to get charged the full price. They're going to get charged a full mina of silver. Now, it will be noticed that in distinction of the self-sale documents in Babylonia cited above, no purchase price is paid to these who entered into servitude. They enter voluntarily into the state of servitude in exchange for food, clothing, and shelter. And this is talking about some other ones. One document succinctly expresses, as long as the master lives, a Habiru servant shall serve him, and the master's food and clothes, or the master shall give him food and clothing. Furthermore, the man and woman who enters the house of a master must remain there as long as the master lives. In the case of desertion, the Habiru becomes subject to the most cruel punishments. On the other hand, we find that in some cases the Habiru is allowed to withdraw, provided he supplies another man in his stead. Now, this is from, the nations. The other nations would require this sort of thing. If you entered into service, you were that person's servant until that person died. Now, what does God say? God says, if you are a Hebrew and you go into service, you only serve for 6 years and then you're freed. You don't stay the life of that master, right? So when we look at it, there's a difference between a slave and a hired person. A slave is a person who entered into a work agreement due to a debt, and they become part of the family and change their identity. Whereas a hired servant, a hired servant is different because they don't have any debt. They're not working to pay off a debt. They're working for their day's wages, and they don't actually integrate into that family. They don't become part of the family that they are the slave to. And that's why they're not allowed to partake in that Passover. Now, it's really interesting here is that the laws of redemption. Now, to look at the laws of redemption of these servants, we can go to this really excellent book. We'll get to that book that I'm talking about here in just a minute. This is another really good book, too. It's called Property and Family in Biblical Law by Raymond Westbrook. And going to page 60, we're going to look at the concept of redemption. Redemption or restitution, the Hebrew word is geula, means the getting back of something that has been lost. It is a restitution of a breach. Right? The breach to be avoided here that they're talking about and where I'm talking in this passage they're talking about is a loss of family. But the law contains no sentimental regulations that the kinsman should assist the needy by keeping the property for his own person. So the whole concept of a redeemer doesn't just go out and purchase back the land and give it back to this relative. The redeemer goes and he would purchase the land and he keeps it himself. So that the land, the center of gravity of this land passes back to a relative. So this land stays within the family. The family loses nothing, but this kinsman redeemer gains this land. Now, of course, we know on the Jubilee year, this would now then return to the original owner. But until that Jubilee year, that redeemer would profit off of it himself. And the same thing goes for the redemption of a slave. Some assistance is to be gained from parallel institutions of redemption from slavery. Here again, the laws give the impression that the slave went free. But evidence from many ancient legal systems and from the Pentateuch itself shows that redemption was often no more than a change of master, although perhaps with enhanced chances of ultimate freedom. Right? So this, if I went into debt and sold myself as a slave, my kinsman had the right to redeem me, but that didn't mean now I'm free to go do whatever I want and get myself back into trouble. That simply meant that I'm no longer a slave to the person I sold myself to. I'm now a slave to my kinsman, right? And that was actually the moral duty of the kinsman in order to, once again, maintain that family unit. It's restoring that soul back to the family unit, because if you're a slave to another household, you've essentially become part of that household. And that's really interesting, because one of the themes of the Exodus narrative is that the transfer of Israelites from Pharaoh's service to that of God's service, right? They were slaves to Pharaoh, and then they are free. They're redeemed out of Egypt, but they aren't now free to go serve whoever they want, are they? No, they are now transferred to the service of God. Sometimes, quite possibly, the Israelites are thought of as less than slaves to be rescued in relation then that is property withheld from the original owner to be regained by him. The principle of a change of master would play the same role on this basis as on the other. The loss of inherited property affected the integrity of the family much more than the loss of the member. Whenever God acts as with the mighty relation and protector of the people, or as their own legitimate owner, the result of their deliverance must be the substitution of his rule for Pharaoh's. Right? So that's why he took them out and he immediately gave them rules, because he took, they had sold themselves as slaves to Pharaoh. He came out, he said, no, you're my family, you're my kinsmen, I'm going to redeem you. And he paid, he gave Egypt his ransom. The payment to redeem Israel was actually the blood of the firstborn of Egypt. And he redeemed them out of there so that they could serve him. And that's why, you know, they didn't have a choice. It wasn't, you're out there now, who, you know, raise your hand, who wants to serve me? Those who didn't serve him were committing treason against their new master, and they were to be put to death. Makes a lot more sense now, doesn't it? Now, the last thing that we're going to look at here is the king's justice. This is the book. If you want a good book on law in the ancient Near East, this is a short one. It's called Everyday Law in Biblical Israel, an Introduction by Raymond Westbrook and Bruce Wells. And we're going to go near to the back of the book here on under social justice, and we're going to look at some of these things. Landlessness and enslavement of the formerly free class could have been a grave consequence for the social equilibrium of a society. Ancient rulers took steps to relieve the burden of debt and restore social equilibrium. Their actions were seen as religious as well as political duty, and an important part of the divine mandate that the ruler received and legitimized his rule to do justice. So whenever it's talking about justice, it's talking about this idea of taking care of those who are landless and who become enslaved. And the whole concept of a jubilee wasn't something that was unfamiliar to all the other nations. In fact, when we look here, the ruler personally decreed the general cancellation of debts and the return of property and persons pledged or sold because of debts. This radical measure was most commonly exercised on ascension to the throne by a new monarch. However, it could be on occasion by other events, such as crisis, as a famine or a war, or petition by the servants. So, basically, in the ancient Near East, a king kind of at his leisure could just go and just periodically cancel all debts and restore all property back to the original owners. And he could do this for a multitude of reasons. Some of the time it was actually just to win favor from the people so that the people didn't rise up and overthrow him. This would be like a political game against the other nobles in the land. When we look at what Yahweh did, Yahweh didn't say, at my whim, I'm gonna casually release you. He set specific time limits on it. He told people, look, you've got these time limits, but you don't make loans based on, you know, what you're going to get. You're supposed to just loan with your hand open, and every 50 years, we're going to go ahead and reset. So those families that suffered because of one family member's poor decisions, once every 50 years, those decisions are reset. And you look, think about it today. In today's system, we don't have a year of jubilee in the U.S. We don't have a resetting of debts. Instead, what we do is we basically pile these debts on a person, on a person, on a person until they file for bankruptcy, at which point both parties lose out, right? The people who owe money, or who are owed money, the creditors, they just lost all of the money that they were supposed to get. They don't get a penny of it, right? Now, the person who had those debts, he now also suffers because now his credit is ruined, right? In Yahweh's kingdom, it's a lot smarter than that. He says, you all are going to know about this. We're going to wipe out the debt once every 50 years, so these people are not going to do this. And this promotes a social responsibility then, right? People are going to be much more interested in giving the people the proper tools to make sure that when they loan them money, that their investments are wise, right? And so when those debts are released, that person now, they don't turn around and have bad credit. They are able to enjoy the fruit of their land and their labor now. Whereas these people who own the property to begin with, they already have their own property. So it's not like they are getting robbed into poverty themselves just because someone, you know, lost it. They basically took part of their vast kingdom and they gave it back to this poor person. You know, and Proverbs themselves tell us that a person who lends to the poor essentially makes a loan to Yahweh. And that's exactly what the Torah portion here tells us, is that if you do these things, Yahweh your Elohim shall bless you as he promised, and you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. And you shall rule over many nations, but they do not rule over you. So I believe the important thing here to take away from this is that if we trust Yahweh and lend freely to our brothers who are in need, we show our faith in Yahweh that we know that He will take care of us, He will bless us, and He will prosper us for these things. But, you know, on the flip side of that, if you're that person who goes out and squanders their money or is in a situation, here Yahweh has set up a system that you're going to be punished for what you know occurred. You're going to be a slave for those 6 years, but in the end you're going to be restored, and not just restored back to ground zero. You're going to be restored with a huge blessing instead. And we know that this the scriptures tell us of this 6,000 year period where man is a servant to either sin and death or to Yahweh and life. We're either a servant of Satan or a servant of the creator of the universe. But we're a servant during these 6,000 years, whichever master we choose to be under. But at the end of those 6,000 years, at the 7,000th year, regardless of how impoverished you are now, if you've chosen the right master, you're going to get riches beyond imagining. He's going to open up those floodgates to you. So I hope you've enjoyed this concept block here, and I hope, you know, in the future, if you hear someone talking about how horrible it was that the Bible promotes slavery, that you're now equipped to understand what exactly slavery meant and why people actually went into slavery. It's not that it was, the brutal capturing of a race of people or just because of their skin color. But it was a means by which someone could pay off debt. And without us understanding their culture, we're never going to understand the scriptures themselves. So Yahweh bless you and keep you. And until next time, Shalom.